welcome to Writing the Wrong Way, where we talk about how writing works, how writers work, and why the best writers risk being strange. And my special guest today is producer extraordinaire Dan Vadeboncœur, who is venturing into the world of screenwriting. Dan, tell people a little bit about your screenwriting project.
Okay, well, I'm writing a movie called Meat House, and this began as a story-breaking episode. I'm sure you've talked about story-breaking before on the podcast. We did this on Super Pulp Science, which you can listen to. I'll link to the episode in the show notes because I also produced this podcast. Basically, we story broke with director Steve Kostanski. You may remember him from such films as The Void or Psycho Gorman, among others. He was at my event, and we came up with the idea of a story of a house that comes to life, basically a house that becomes flesh. That was kind of the central idea of the thing we came up with. And so I took that and I spun it off into an idea for a movie. So I want to write this. And it's something that I really think is a good idea for a film. It's the really first time I felt like motivated to write something creatively. I've never really done any creative writing. And so I just kind of want to really take this seriously, and I'm asking you for help.
Yeah, and just to give a bit of context, so I'm a writer of different stripes, as people listen to this podcast knows. One of the things I've done a fair amount of is different is screenwriting. I've done some directing, I've done some screenwriting. I teach a course on screenwriting, so one of the sort of fortuitous things here is I am gearing, I just signed last week my deal to do the course again in the winter term at the University of Winnipeg. And so I'm kind of gearing up in my head, like, for how I might want to alter that course or change it. And one of the things that I'm doing in that course and that I'm going to do for you all here is talk through some of the basic rules I give beginning screenwriters. So now the reason I know that, of course, in some ways, giving rules is the antithesis of writing the wrong way. But what I've found in my creative writing courses, and when I talk about creative writing, is the best thing a beginner writer can do is just quickly move past the point where they're making a handful of basic decisions that everyone else is struggling to deal with. Like, if you just, I found that there's a handful of things you can do as a writer where if you just do them, you immediately move past 50% of the other writers out there. And yes, you might, you know, backtrack on some of these things at some future point. You know, you might figure out how to do something well rather than just avoiding it entirely. But for the most part, there's like a handful of things usually in whatever discipline you're in. If you just accept that you're going to accept these rules, you quickly jump past a bunch of people. You can start focusing in on what it is that you do well, and then maybe you backtrack on some of these quote unquote rules. So again, I say they're rules for beginning screenwriters. Now, I would honestly advise non-beginners to follow most of these quote-unquote rules, but I'll explain kind of what they are and why. And Dan is going to jump in and just kind of ask me for more clarity or just move me further I'm lingering too long on something.
And I might argue with you a little bit too.
Yeah, and so that's, I think it's nice rather than me just kind of talking, like, why not get a bit of a debate? And then I think also this will help you with your Meat House.
Right.
Now, again, I've got kind of 10 rules that I think all beginning screenwriters should just adopt unthinkingly, but I will explain why. I've got a bonus rule for horror writers, which is relevant to Dan. And I've got, before I begin, I just want to get into two premises. So there are two basic assumptions about screenwriting itself that is often very difficult for writers to understand, especially if you're not really in this position exactly, but people who come from another field into screenwriting. So if they've been working on novels or poetry or something, the biggest problem they have often, because they usually can write quite well, but often they cannot write screenplays. And the reason why is often because they have these two ideas in their head, or rather they don't have two ideas in their head that they need to really quickly adopt to understand what they're doing. So the core premise you need to first comprehend if you're going to get into screenwriting is you are not the artist here. You are not the artist. Now, you could argue there's a level of artistry to what you're doing, but the fact is you are writing a screenplay. A screenplay is not a literary document. A screenplay will not be read by the audience for the movie. The movie is the art object. The movie is made by other people who are artists that you are providing a blueprint for. And so everything you're doing in that document has to be structured around the fact that you are not presenting it to the audience. you're presenting it to people who are then going to make a movie. And so you're going to see when I go through these rules, there's a lot of things that are really specific to screenwriting in the sense that they are here and they are quote unquote rules, because this is you helping other people do their jobs. You're serving these other artists. You're not scooping those artists. You're not doing the job for them. And you're not, you're just kind of putting them in a position to do a good job. Yes, to do it in the way you want them to do it, rather than fighting with them about it. So you'll kind of, some of what you're doing as a screener is kind of manipulating a situation where another person can do a great job. And you have to be really clear on that's the thing you're doing. You're a blueprint provider rather than, you know, your message is getting across the audience, because it will not, unless you paradoxically think of yourself as not the artist, but a servant to the artist.
Yeah. And so to me, that means don't be too precious about this thing that you're creating. It's going to be modified. It's going to be changed. Other people are going to want their say into it. So you cannot live and die on these plot points or whatever happens to these characters or whatever. You know, you have to be flexible in this situation.
It's that, but it's also, I'll get into like some specific examples as to it, but it's also things like you have to write it a certain way and do and don't do certain things so that other people can do their jobs the way you want them to, as opposed to taking over.
Or leaving things open to interpretation.
Yeah,
right?
You want a level of interpretation, a level that will serve the artist in them, and you want not to have level of interpretation.
Or misinterpretation, I guess, right?
That will provide them with the chance to take the movie away from you. So, like, it's sort of a weird balancing act. But again, this will make more sense as we get more fully into the examples.
Okay.
The other big premise, the thing that you have to understand, and this is more of a metaphor, although it is true, is movies cost $1 million. Now, of course, most cost more, some cost less. But think in your head, this is a good concrete metaphor for the problem. Movies cost $1 million. There are already so many problems, so many obstacles, so many hurdles in the way of you making this movie. Do not add more obstacles inside the script. You know, movies cost $1 million. Like, have that in your head all the time. When you're writing a page, what I like to often say to students is, like, read this page and tell me, would you pay $10,000 to put that on screen? Would you yourself pay $10,000? Because it may cost $100,000. But if it's not worth $10,000, cut it. Like, that's sort of where it's at, you know? Like, you're in that realm of, you got to really think of this document as something that you cannot do anything with. Unless you get an army and $1 million together. So it has to, one, be that good, like good enough to get to put $1 million in an army behind. But also, do not build into the script reasons why it could not be made. Do not build in things that cost too much, you know, unless you have a $100 million budget. Like, if you got a budget in advance, it's different maybe. Mm. But even then, what you'll find is it helps to just have it in your head always, like, that you don't need more problems than you already have before you start writing a movie.
Does it help to have knowledge of the movie making process to do this?
It does, but again, the rules will sort of take care of some of that for you. So yes, though, is the short answer.
Yeah, and so when we get onto the rules, when I read this, it sent this to me after I asked you to help me with this, and I read through these, and what it seemed to me is that these are rules intended to, now, again, I think they're more actually guidelines is maybe even a better word, because they're intended to help people not do what they've been doing so far in their writing career or whatever. It's intended to shift people away from certain, like, then writing just prose and up till now, just novels and short stories. This, because the first rule is like, okay, I see, because you can write, anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself.
So the first rule is no one thinks ever.
Right.
Now, the reason for that is in a screenplay, you can only write what the audience sees and hears. That's how movies work. So again, part of this also is you got to think of you're making a movie, right?
Right.
It's got to be cinematic. And so you're going to make cinematic choices. Like, a lot of the work of being a writer of screenplays is thinking cinematically, which can be very difficult, especially for somebody like me, you know, who comes into it from a place of poetry, a place of prose. Like, in prose, you have the ability to go inside the character's head. You have the ability to relay information directly to the reader, you know, and tell them things. There are ways to do that in cinema, but they tend not to be cinematic.
Right.
So they tend to be like, you know, you can go in a voiceover into the character's head. Yes, there are examples where it works well. Generally, nobody can do it well. But even more so, it's not cinematic. So even if you're doing it well, you're actually doing a non-movie thing inside a movie. So again, for a beginner, I would say it's best to just adopt the rule that nobody thinks ever. What you usually see is not that people are trying to do voiceover, is that they're writing things into a script that cannot be shot and cannot be filmed. Once you write something into a script that cannot be filmed, what you get into this is this scenario where you're not the artist. Someone else now has to decide how to film it. Mm-hmm. So they're going to now take the movie away from you on a certain mm-hmm. level. They're going to make an artistic choice that you haven't made. And, you know, sometimes that's good and fine and appropriate, but other times you have a very specific thing in your head and you're putting it inside a character's head. But again, they cannot get that out of the character's head and into the audience's head. No one thinks ever in a script. So it's sort of a shorthand for only write what the audience can see and hear. If you write something like Bob is sad looking at the stars, that cannot be filmed. Now, an actor could look sad, an actor could look at the stars, but it just doesn't translate cinematically unless the actor does all the work, the cinematographer does all the work. It doesn't belong in the script. You need to find a visual or audio analog to what that is. You'd actually be better off in that example giving shots of stars and then having like a person crying, for example.
Right.
That's a bad example, but like, again, at least a crying, I know they're sad, right? Like well, I visually see like something about their sadness. Now, maybe that changes, but they're not going to be confused. So like if you write something like Bob stares out the window, well, what the fuck does that mean?
Yeah, exactly.
And what is he thinking? Nobody knows.
Nobody cares. Well, the thing is, and then for me, I saw that rule and I said, okay, this is meant to direct people away from prose
yes.
where you can see the thoughts, but also it's my immediate thought went to voiceover. Whenever we see voiceover added, that's the inner monologue of somebody telling a story or a flashback. It's lame almost always. And like, I just feel like it ruined Blade Runner. So I don't want to use that.
But if you want to write voiceover, write voiceover. Don't write their thoughts.
Yes.
Inside
yes. It's,
their
it's a voiceover narration. It's not just what they're thinking in the moment.
Exactly. Right. Now I wouldn't suggest writing voiceover necessarily for most writers, especially for beginning writers, like I say, because it's a very complex, difficult thing. But, you know, for the most part, just anytime you write somebody thinking anything in any way, shape, or form, get it out of their heads. Have them say something, have them do something, have a shot of a frog, like anything, man. Anything that would convey visually or auditorily instead.
Okay.
Because if you just have shots of the actor's face all the time, like your screenplay has no cinematic interest.
I have noticed that, actually. I can't think of a specific movie, but I have noticed that, you know, sometimes you'll see just a cutaway to something, you know, really quickly just to show an image in the person's head. That's something more avant-garde, maybe. Okay,
but
so...
again, that's even better. But, like, so rule two, just to kind of move on a little
yeah,
bit.
Yeah, let's move on.
Is no one talks inside a car. We were having a little discussion with this. So the reason no one talks inside of a car, Dan, and this is a rule, is
okay.
One, it is one of the most difficult things to shoot is a conversation inside of a car. That's just logistically complex. It requires so much money and time, and you have to cut the car in half sometimes. Like, it gets very complicated very fast for so little payoff. If they're talking inside of a car, so again... unless you're literally in the middle of a car chase or it's Fast and the Furious and the whole thing is about wearing cars, doing car things. If the car is simply serving as a location, it's a bad location. It's a boring location that we see all the time in movies. It's hard to shoot, and the payoff for being hard to shoot and expensive is that it's boring as shit. So any other location is better than a car. It's easier to shoot. It looks better. Cars don't even look good inside.
No.
Again, if it's a conversation, if they're talking, if they're not doing something in the car, they're just having a conversation. Typically, what it is that conversation is what matters. The location does not matter. So find a more interesting location. Again, find a cinematic location. Find something that's cheaper, that makes more is more interesting to look at. Put them on a Ferris wheel. Put them anywhere in the world. I wouldn't put them on a Ferris wheel necessarily, but at least you could cheat a Ferris wheel easier than you could cheat being in a car.
Yeah. And so I, you know, I was so proud of myself. I went through these and said, oh, I haven't broken any of his rules because I thought I hadn't, but I have broken this rule because I have a conversation in a truck. But it's only because of when it takes place in the story. I want these characters to talk about what they're doing and set up the story as they're driving to a location. So just trying to be a time saver more than anything else. No,
it's
you do not get to be
saver.
In this. Go
it's
going to
cost you an extra day.
This guy wants to get on it.
Gregory wants to say in.
What do you want to say?
I want to tell you, just have them loading the truck.
Yeah.
They've already loaded it when we start the movie.
Have them unloading.
They don't load it till they get there. Anyway, we'll get into it after.
The point is that scene
could
be
stopping
improved
for a lunch
instantly.
Break.
That scene could be improved instantly by not setting it inside of a car. Plus, it'll be cheaper. Plus, it'll look better. Plus, it's not the same boring shit you always see.
Yeah,
now,
I mean, I just thought
furious,
of it. They could be at a rest
different.
Stop. They could just be at a rest stop on the highway, going to
There's
that.
There's 100 ways it could be easier,
it's a 5-minute
and
conversation.
Simpler, and look better. Now, later on, you get into like, should they have that conversation? But like, you know, assuming they should. Yes.
Okay. Now, first, before we move on to the third rule, I want to say everybody breaks this second rule.
It's a terrible idea.
Many conversations in cars that happen all the time.
Yep.
So that's why I kind of thought, what are you talking about? It's just done everywhere.
But it's exactly why you should never do it.
Right.
Because part of the thing you're doing as a beginning screenwriter is as fast as possible, you need to not be a beginning screenwriter.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
As fast as possible, you need to set yourself apart from other people. Because the game of it in many ways, and this is true of all writing, like the game of it is how fast can I get away from doing what other people are doing and standing out from the crowd and still being good, being better than they are.
Mm-hmm.
And the simplest, fastest way to do it is to X out everything that everyone else is doing that actually isn't necessarily a great idea.
Okay. Makes sense.
Now, third one's really simple. No characters can have names that begin with the same letter of the alphabet. This is because when people read your script, they're going to skim the script.
Yeah.
And they're going to get confused who's speaking if the characters are the same letters of the alphabet as their
name. Yeah, or if they have similar-looking names like Dave and Dan and stuff like that.
Yeah, have a Dave and a Dan in the same script. Never have a Laura and a Lisa in the same script.
Okay.
It's just a really simple technical thing, but it actually makes a big difference in the scannability of the script.
Oh.
And you got to understand that a lot of producers, a lot of people who are reading this script are not reading every page of it, and they're often not even reading it carefully. But at a certain point, you know, when they are reading it carefully, it doesn't matter anymore so much. But like for the audience who is hearing words and not just seeing them on the page, it helps just auditorily to have those names start differently and help the audience distinguish who everyone is as they're beginning to learn names. And then it just also for a person reading the script quickly, it just helps even just you yourself to do like your find and replaces or whatever. Like it just helps to just get those names distinct from one another.
I can tell you,
so it's just real technical.
I've named a couple characters after people we know, not you yet, but I was really, my main criteria was making something short and easy to type because I have to type these names over and over again as
well,
I'm.
You shouldn't
writing.
Be doing that. You should have a screenwriting program.
Yeah, I
know.
That I
does it for you.
Okay,
but yes,
that's the. We'll get to that.
You're
but yeah,
right.
I was just trying to
helps.
Keep it short. But I have, I think, two names that I have to change. But that was never like the names are not important in this necessarily. It's just something placeholders, and I'll probably end up changing them.
But what is important is that if an actor is considering playing Bob, they can skip through and look and see quickly how many lines Bob has.
Bob has, yeah, exactly. Okay.
Good. I know it sounds stupid and small, but it's going to help you get an actor. It's going to help you do all sorts of things. And it's just a simple technical thing that doesn't matter really to your story.
Yeah, but
now,
if
they're
twins, not even thinking about
it. It's different.
Yeah, I had a Jen and I had a Justine, but I'll just change Jen.
Now that's, like, that's a small thing. Four is a bigger thing. So again, cut me off if I'm getting too deep in the weeds here. But four is no character dialogue should ever say what the character means.
Okay, what does that mean?
Now here's the reason for this. So my favorite quote on this is from Robert McKee, the screenwriting guru who wrote Story. And he has a great quote. He says, if any character in a movie says I love you to another person and it actually means it, that scene is dead like a dog in the road. Now, what he means, though, is that if a character is saying exactly what they mean, then that dialogue has no subtext. Now, the problem with this, again, just to define subtext quickly for people, subtext is the meaning that is underneath the words that are being said. So if I say to you, nice hair, and I'm being sarcastic, the subtext is your hair looks bad. But my surface level that is I'm saying nice hair. So that line has subtext. You can read the subtext because of how I say the line, et cetera, et cetera. You know if I'm insulting your hair because of my tone of voice, for example. The same is true when characters are saying things like in movies where, again, they're saying some words, and what matters is not the words they're saying, it's what they mean underneath those words. Now, here's where it gets really technical, and it refers to that you are not the artist here premise. What actors do. Now, remember, you're writing a screenplay, and the words will be said by actors. What actors do is they deliver, they memorize lines, and they deliver the lines, but they play subtext. So what the actor's job fundamentally is to, you know, they're just memorizing the lines so that they don't have to think about them. Because what their real work is delivering subtext. They're delivering a secondary meaning. If actors do not have subtext to work with, they must, then either one of two things happens. One, you have a bad actor. A bad actor will say the line with no subtext. The line will be flat. The actor will be lousy. It will be a bad acted movie because they have there is no acting.
Right.
And they're just, you know, they're people bad. Lines, and they don't know that they have a real job to do, which is to just deliver your lines with subtext. Now, or the bad actor will put, they'll if they're a slightly better actor, what they'll do is they'll put subtext into the lines, but it won't be the subtext that you think they should put in. So again, subtext is almost always, it's not always, but it's often ironic in the sense that it often is undercutting the surface meaning. So what you'll get if you don't write subtext into the lines, if you write a line where characters say what they mean, the actor will often load it with the opposite meaning.
Ah, okay.
Because that's their job.
Right. And they're going to assume they have to do that because that's what they do in all their other
exactly.
projects.
Now, if you have a really good actor, they may rewrite your line. That's what a really good actor will do. So when you hear all these stories of like Tom Cruise comes in and like changes all the lines, that's because Tom Cruise knows what the fuck he's doing.
Yeah.
Now, the worst is if they don't So one, your best case scenario, if you don't have character dialogue that has subtext, so if characters are saying what they mean, your best case scenario is the actor rewrites your line, which of course you don't want on a certain level.
Yeah.
Your worst case scenario is the actor says your line and it ruins everything. So it's a very complex problem in many ways, but the simplest workaround, like without just to adopt a rule and get down the road of where you should be with your dialogue writing is just don't have or have characters say what they mean.
Okay, well, what if I go through and I found, oh, this person is saying exactly what they mean. Should I change that?
Change that dialogue so they are not saying directly what they mean.
But it's still saying like partially what they mean, but there's some subtext.
There's a lot of examples. So let's say a character says, I love you, and you want them to mean that. Again, I would just, there's different ways to do that. It kind of becomes context or scene specific. But if a character just says, you start to get into like what else is happening in the scene. Let's say the character's saying, I love you as they go into a burning building. They're going to die in that building, but they want to say, I love you to the person. This is the last thing they're ever going to say to them. So again, in a real world scenario, somebody might say, I love you, but that's not cinematic or interesting. And the actor could take it away from you. So you have them say something else. You have them say something like,
you complete me.
Well,
you had me at hello.
You know what? Like it sounds stupid, but that is a good example.
Well, I know, it's a very good line. Like the whole thing is, when you say that, that is the obvious example That is him telling her, speaking to Tom Cruise in that moment, that he loves her, but he's not saying I love you in that scene.
But even would be better if he said, you know what? I've always hated you. If he says I've always hated you with a smirk and then runs into the burning building,
yeah.
Even that works.
Yeah. Okay.
Both of them are better.
And then just to get back to, I'll take it to Star Wars, we have Princess Leia saying, I love you. And then Han Solo says, I know. And I think that was an improvised line.
So
anyway,
you can see, of course, examples where things work, but generally it's a good rule of thumb to just not have characters say what they mean.
Okay.
Is in all levels.
Yeah, I just think it makes things more interesting.
It also avoids you from doing exposition over exposition.
Yeah, and I would say also makes it more realistic because people frequently don't say what they mean.
Almost never do people say what they mean.
Right.
You get into arguments all the time because of this.
Yes, okay. Next one. No one should ever enter a room or leave a room.
So this is a really simple... This is one for complication of moving in and out of a room. So there's just a logistical component to it. But secondarily, there's a rule in screenwriting which more abstractly put is you should start a scene late and leave it early. So you get to the party late, leave the party early. So just to make it more stripped down for a beginner to understand, like don't have people come into a room and say, hey, how are you doing? Oh, I'm doing fine. Just cut to the action.
Cut to the chase, yeah.
Cut to the chase. Cut to where the scene starts. Where's the conflict in the scene? Just start there or just right after it and then get out as soon as like that scene's reached a climax. So it's just sort of it is a logistical thing because people don't think about entering and leaving rooms and how complicated that can be, especially if it's a set and not a real room. But even if it is a real room, you know, you got to lay tracks, you got to, you know, maybe you got to cut the wall down, like who knows.
Right.
But it just, usually it's just, they, it's a lot of logistical complications simply to have somebody say hello and then they get cut it in editing anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, well, and then just kind of stripping away the unnecessary stuff, right?
Yeah, it's more just a, it's more of a, than anything, a tool to cut out the parts that will always coincide. It's like an action that almost always coincides with unnecessary dialogue and scene work.
Yeah, and we just, I mean, it's just not something we don't need to see because people are going to be entering and leaving rooms the entire movie, and it's just going to be repetition if we keep seeing that over and over again.
And the reality is that the way editing in films work is by a technique called ellipses. So what that means on a simple level for people who haven't heard that term, ellipsis is just when, you know, like you cut out between two, the action that takes place between two instances. Mm-hmm. So if, you know, my favorite example of this is in There Will Be Blood, where he's at the bottom of a well, he's like broken his leg, he's lying in the desert, but he struck oil. Cut to, he's in town.
That's right.
How did he get into town? Well, we didn't need to see him walking all the way with a broken leg for 10 hours or whatever, you know, it would take to show us that. Mm-hmm. But just the fact that he did it is all we need to know. It tells us, one, it just moves the plot along, but two, it tells us about that guy. Even with a broken leg, he's going to get down to that office, you know,
mm-hmm.
and get that land title.
Absolutely. Okay, number six.
So just quickly to tag that, though,
okay.
My point here is if you have people entering rooms and leaving rooms in your script, it will end up on the editing floor. So you'll pay $20,000 and then cut it out.
Mm. Okay.
Number six is nothing in the script is longer than four lines. This is a big problem that people have when they write screenplays, almost always. So there's a handful of things you can write in screenplays. There's like five things you can write or six things. I can't remember off the top of my head because I always mix it up with what you can write in prose. But there's like between five and seven actual things you can write in a script. The two that actually go on for any length are dialogue and description or action. What's happening on screen. So dialogue, if you ever have dialogue longer than four lines, you actually have a character delivering a speech.
Right.
Now, usually your dialogue should be one, two lines. Three lines is quite long. It doesn't seem that way when you look at it on a piece of paper, especially because of how they format dialogue. But in reality, once you've got like three, four lines, you're actually edging into speech territory. And the thing you have to understand is when a character is delivering a speech, the other characters are not talking. And it's really unnatural. It's really weird. And imagine a movie where every 2 minutes, somebody gives a speech. That's how most screenplays by beginning screenwriters look.
Yeah.
Is like, you can, so one, I can glance at that script. Like having, if you've a person, like a producer who's read a lot of scripts, you can literally flip through the script without reading it and just see based on how long the dialogue is, whether it's a good script or not.
Okay.
So people will and should throw scripts away because the dialogue keeps going on longer than four lines. They don't have that number in their head necessarily, but broadly speaking, that's kind of the ballpark of where you're getting into speech-defying territory. And while it is possible to do speeches well in movies, for the most part, beginning screenwriters cannot do it. And then with description, the same thing is true. If you have the description, if you have it going on for more than four lines, what you probably are actually doing is describing multiple things inside of a paragraph.
Right.
And you need to separate those with paragraph breaks for the purposes of, putting that production together more efficiently.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. So I will eventually show you this script. I see a few areas where I can improve this and just kind of tighten up the dialogue, try and say it in fewer words, or maybe assign somebody else to say the lines or something like that. That's something you can do to...
Or just have an action in between the dialogue. Like, that's another thing. Another thing with the rule is, like, if you've got really long speeches, if somebody's just doing things in the course of giving a speech, that can, one, you break up that speech with actual action
yeah.
and them doing stuff, and then visually in the script, it breaks it up too. So even if you do have a speech for some significant reason, again, don't forget to give them something to do during that speech. And it's just sort of, it helps you with that, but for the most part, it's to help you avoid speeches.
Okay. Cool. What's next?
Now, this is the most arbitrary of these rules.
Okay.
And it's the one I personally like to break, but again, I would generally advise people beginning not to break this rule, which is no scene is longer than 3 pages. Most scenes should be 1 to 2 pages in a script. The problem that beginner writers often have is they tend to overwrite. So one, they'll go on too long, but more importantly, they often will repeat things, which is another rule that's coming up here. In fact, the next rule is no one ever repeats themselves. So these always like go together in some
right.
ways. But if you ever have somebody repeating themselves, either the thing they're saying is being repeated or an action they're doing is being repeated, you need to start cutting.
Okay. What if there's, and I mean, I have a problem.
Now, let's just define what a scene is though, Dan.
Yeah, sure.
Because in a movie, a scene is when you change time or you change location.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime you change the time or the location, you have a new scene heading and you're in a new scene.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're ever in the same time and location for more than 3 minutes in a movie, it's actually a very, very long time. It doesn't sound like it is, but 3 minutes is a long time in a movie.
Right.
And so again, you know, it's the one I would say probably will most usefully get broken. But like if you're in the Meat House, for example, there like it's broadly speaking, you're probably going to be mostly in the same time. Like you're probably not jumping in time a whole lot.
No, it's all in the same like couple week period or whatever. Yeah.
So time could even just be 5 minutes later. It doesn't have to be like a day later. But like, but you're probably not jumping time as much, especially when you're in the heat of the action.
Mm-hmm.
But you're probably moving around the house a lot. So cinematically, it's a good reminder to just get people moving around from location to location, especially if you're in a house. I would say this is the most optional rule in some ways. But again, what I find is, for the most part, if you're not jumping around enough, either there's not enough happening in the plot typically, or you're just spending too much time repeating things.
Okay.
But I would say, you know, I will say that that's probably the one to worry about the least. But I almost never see a script. There are examples. Like, I want to call Robert Eggers a beginning screenwriter.
Yeah.
But like, The Witch has an incredibly long scene in it. I think it's like 30 pages. And it's brilliant. But, you know, if you're not Robert Eggers and you're not there yet, you're better off just keeping to the rule, because it's going to solve a lot of your other problems for you.
Yeah.
And this is in some ways more why I prescribe rules to beginning writers. It's not that they have to do things a certain way in their career necessarily, but it's that they're probably doing certain things that they need to stop doing.
Mm-hmm.
And the rules just help you stop without, you know, without having to get into it too complexly.
Okay. No one ever repeats themselves in which way?
So we've sort of dealt with that a little bit, but so rule 8, no one ever repeats themselves. So people should not say the same thing twice. People should not do the same thing twice, broadly speaking.
I want to have a line, a funny line, come back over and over again.
So that's a callback
joke.
So in that instance, what you're going to end up doing to make that work is you'll have to change the context.
Yes. Yeah.
So, you know, that's, I guess, an exception in a certain sense. Technically, so I would argue that's not structurally. It's more about structural repetition in many ways. So in that case, what you're actually going to be doing is changing the subtext.
Okay.
So the subtext won't repeat, even if the line is repeating.
And so we need to
it doesn't work as a joke.
So this is just, it's just about not repeating information.
Yeah,
not,
it's more like, about the structural repetition. It's more about, like, characters aren't doing, like, the same things from a structural point of view. So I know that can get abstract, but very fast. But yeah, you know, technically speaking, you're right. There are certain instances where you would have people repeating things and that would work fine, but you'd have to change it. You'd basically have to change enough so that it is kind of a new thing.
Mm-hmm.
So again, to make a callback joke work, you have to change the subtext so that now it's kind of funny that they're saying this thing they were saying before, because it doesn't match this context anymore.
I get it. Gotcha. Number 9.
No two people in a scene can ever agree. if there are ever two people in a scene agreeing, then either one of two things is taking place. Either one, there is no conflict in the scene. Or two, there are two people serving the same structural function inside the scene. So again, for logistical reasons, you typically want to cut people who don't need to be there. But also, if they just are there, like if the story demands they're in the room because everyone's trapped in this room, you don't need them contributing to the conversation the same way another person is contributing. Like if they're there, they need to do something to justify being there on a structural level. And that means adding to the conflict of the scene.
Mm-hmm. Is it okay to have two people agree if you have somebody else in the room to disagree with them?
I would say those two people are now serving the same function.
Okay.
So why are there two of them?
Well, there might just be more than two people in the room. And
exactly. But if there's more than two people in the room, say there's three people in the room and two of them fundamentally agree. Like, let's say this is the situation. Three people in a room. Two people are like, we need to get out of this room. One person is like, no, let's stay in this room. The two people who want to get out of the room should disagree about how.
Okay.
That makes the scene immediately more interesting, and it gives three places, like it gives you three positions to conflict between.
Mm-hmm.
And then again, like the scene ends up with two people unhappy and one person getting their way. Mm-hmm. So now you're feeding into the next scene's conflict and like so on and so forth. So it's just, anytime you have people structurally repeating one another, you very quickly get into the question of why is that happening?
Mm-hmm.
And often why it's happening is because there's too many characters in the script in the first place.
Okay.
Now, you may have some, you'd be picking characters off at a certain. So yeah. On some level, you do have people there for no apparent reason, typically. But you still want there to be a reason story-wise they're there, even if they're going to get picked off.
Sure, yeah. Well, they're there to get picked off. I mean, that's the reason they're there.
Yeah, but also it's best if they contribute to the story's development as or before they get picked off.
Okay.
And the only way to develop a story is to increase its conflict and escalate conflict.
That's right.
That's what stories are. Stories are conflict escalating.
Interesting. Okay. And then rule number 10, no one talks on the phone ever.
No one talks on the phone ever is the rule, because the least cinematic thing you could possibly put into a movie is a phone conversation. There's nothing more boring to look at on screen than a phone conversation.
Yeah, I'll say it again. It's done all the time. You see it
all the time. And it is the worst possible use of any actor's time.
Yeah.
It looks terrible. It does nothing to advance a story. It's just the most brutal thing in the world.
I've noticed this. I'm going to go on a Star Trek tangent for a second. But on Star Trek, of course, they do a lot of conversations through view screens, right? And they will have to talk to the Admiral on a view
screen. Star Trek is boring cinematic.
Well, it is,
that's
yes.
My...
that's
now,
fair.
There's different Star Treks that are better. But broadly speaking, that's my complaint about
Star
Trek.
But I think
Trek.
What they're doing in the newer Star Treks is they have a hologram show up. So that it looks like the two people in the same room talking to each other instead of having a
TV I personally screen. Don't like scenes where people are just talking to one another.
Okay,
because
fair.
I think they're boring scenes. Yeah. But the worst offender is the phone conversation.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, and that's fine. I mean, that's not going to happen in my story, but it's... Well, okay.
Now,
if there's going to be talking on the phone before... someone's going to refer to a phone conversation, that kind of thing.
Something that... I mean... Yeah, that actually accomplishes all the story function you would need that scene to have. But the other sort of corollary here, where I almost put this in as a rule, but you know, it's a harder thing for people often to understand. But like, do you know what business is when we're talking about acting? What an actor's business is?
Business, like.
So yeah, in acting, actors will often refer to business. So what? When an actor talks about business, what they mean is what they're doing with their hands, what they're doing while they're in the scene. And so one of the things that will always happen, so one of the rules I almost put in here is people should be always, you know, be doing something with their hands. But that's really hard to understand abstract idea. And of course, people just put a phone in the hands.
Yeah.
But what an actor will do realistically, a lot of the time, is figure out, you know, actors are always thinking about what is the subtext and what am I doing with my hands. So ideally, you want to put the subtext in the script and give them something to do with their hands.
Okay.
And a phone conversation is almost always a conversation where people are relaying information to one another and there's no subtext.
Mm-hmm.
But in addition, they're doing something boring with their hands.
Mm-hmm. They're just holding a phone. Yeah, I get it for sure. And then a bonus rule for horror.
Yeah, this is my bonus rule for horror. It's not a bad rule for other screenwriting, but the bonus rule for horror is no one dreams.
Except for in Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah, that's an exception, though, and for this reason. So the problem with dreaming in movies and in stories generally is that, but it's especially true in movies. Movies are all about plot and plot significance, with exceptions like in the avant-garde cinema.
Mm-hmm.
But broadly speaking, movies are about plot and pushing the plot forward through conflict escalation scene by scene. Conflict escalation, causality, one scene feeds in the next, so on and so forth. By definition, dreams do not have plot consequence. The exception being a film like Nightmare on Elm Street, where what happens in the dream is effectively happening in
right.
real life.
Yeah.
But in a normal movie, and horror movie, this is especially true. In a normal movie, a dream by definition has no plot consequence. And in horror, it has the additional problem of revealing to the audience what will happen. Because in dreams, in horror, everything that happens in a dream is true. So if someone dreams that, like, you know, Sarah's really, you know, a serial killer, in fact, Sarah is a serial killer.
Right.
And you just don't know it yet. But now the audience knows.
Yeah. It's also used as a fake out quite a bit in horror movies, I find. Like, you'll see a scene in which somebody gets killed. Oh, it was just a dream. They just dreamed of getting killed,
it's
right?
It's dreamed of getting killed. So, one, they will be killed.
Right.
So now the audience it ruins the later scene when they do get killed. All the surprises bled out of that scene.
Mm-hmm.
But two, there was no plot consequence, so it just becomes a jump scare.
So why do people use dream scenes then?
Because visually, they are often cinematic.
Mm-hmm. And you really can do whatever you want in a dream, I guess, eh?
Directors love dream sequences because they can put whatever they want visually. But your job, Jan, is to put something visual and interesting in the fucking movie.
That's right.
That actually matters and is happening
right.
in the plot.
Right. Okay.
People will put the best stuff in a dream where it doesn't fucking matter. Like, mm-hmm. It's so unreal. Like, it blows my mind. And in horror is the worst offender because, as you say, it bleeds it out. So if you actually have a real scary scene and you put it in a dream, all of a sudden it didn't fucking matter.
Yeah.
The guy's not even dead.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's just completely takes the wind out of everything.
It's unreal. Like, horror is, again, it's generally speaking a good idea. Again, I'm just talking beginner screenwriters. Like, you know, and you could argue that is a rule you would break in an instance like Nightmare on Elm Street, where it's like, you know, dreams actually don't differentiate themselves from the waking world in any meaningful way. So you could argue, I would argue that Nightmare on Elm Street dreams actually are not dreams.
Right. And that's the premise of the film.
So they're not really dreaming on a certain level.
And yeah, and everything happens in the dream does matter to the plot in Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
But that's, unless that is the case, unless, you know, you die in Canada and therefore you die in real life, we don't have a dream.
Right. That's fine by me. I wasn't planning on it. Okay, cool. So those are the rules. That's good. I'm glad to have those so that I can kind of keep those in my head as I'm writing. I'm going to go through what I've written already and tighten it up based on this.
Now, every time you see an exception, though, you bring up the example that you can, of course, watch movies and see all sorts of exceptions to these rules. But here's the question I will always ask. When you see an exception to the rule, would they have been better off to just follow the rule?
Right. Yeah, I can probably think of some examples of that. And, you know, just like, I get that these are just trying to help me and save me time, save me from making the same mistakes that you have made over many years.
Exactly.
And I appreciate that. Thank you for that. So, and that, yeah, so probably, you know, maybe more people need to read these rules.
Yeah. And again, as you kind of get more confident as a screenwriter, I mean, I would say abandon the quote unquote rules at your peril, but there are reasonable ways to to break these rules, just like there's reasonable ways to use voiceover and so on and so forth. But, you know, if you're beginning and starting out, unless you're some sort of screenwriting savant or some sort of screenwriting genius, you know, you simply aren't going to be able to effectively break these rules. And if you follow if you do break the rules, again, you're in this bad position of instantly being doing the thing that most people are doing. And that's the worst thing you can do at the start as a writer is what everyone else is doing, because there's no reason then to read your writing.
Okay. Can I ask you some questions now? Just general questions.
If there's time. I know you got another podcast.
No, yeah, but I got time. I got a few minutes.
I got time.
So generally, how long would you say it takes to write a screenplay?
It depends on your schedule is a short answer, Dan.
Sure.
I think somebody should be able to write, if you spend a month planning and outlining and then 2 months writing, I think that would be, and then another, month revising and rewriting, I think 3 to 4 months is a reasonable time frame to condense writing a screenplay into. I've written a screenplays in a month. I would say most people, you're in the 3 months to a year.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good thing to know. But generally...
But what will be faster, the fastest way to write a screenplay is to outline, to not write it, and to outline everything on cards.
Ah, okay.
And then write from the cards.
Okay, so like every scene has a different card, every action...
I forget who said it, but when some famous screenwriting teacher once said that screenwriting is structure.
Okay.
And there is ways in which that is not true, but ways in which that's very true. Now, the flip side is... Gregory actually has a really useful technique that I've used when I'm stuck, where he just writes dialogue back and forth, people arguing. He doesn't write anything else.
Yeah, he just talks to himself, actually. He's told me about that.
Yeah. Now, what I've found is that that doesn't, is really good if you, so again, if you just write dialogue that doesn't have subtext, but just people talking back and forth, and then you do a pass where you just, you pull out what's the structure here, and you start replacing all that dialogue.
Yeah.
With, you know, other things that they're, where they're not saying what they mean, or you just replace the dialogue with action. You can draft a scene very quickly that way, and then focus on revising it and making it better and better and better. So what I like to do, I feel the fastest way to write a screenplay is you outline everything on cards, then you go scene by scene and do just a back and forth dialogue kind of pass, like a la Gregory's system, and then you revise.
Okay.
But I feel like that I've found that that is not the easiest approach for most people.
Well, what I started doing is just starting at the beginning and just writing my way through each scene as it comes to me. And I have an outline of the kind of main plot points, but there's a lot that I need to fill in the middle.
Yes. Right? I would say that's not a good use of your time.
Probably not. Okay.
At this point.
Yeah.
What's the best use of your time is putting everything on cards.
Okay.
And what I mean, so that gets into like a structural issue, but you know, there is something to be said for just writing words and being in the writing of words system. It's just how much rewriting do you want to do, how fast do you want to write this thing, you know, how much rewriting do you want to do. Sometimes, well, as a beginner, it's good to do a lot of extra rewriting you don't need to do because you're practicing, but other times you just want to be efficient.
But also I find the rewriting is holding me back a little bit. I'm getting into the habit at my job at CTV, because I write 500 to 1,000 word articles. I reread them all the time, constantly. Whenever I hit the end of whatever I've written, I start at the beginning, I rewrite as I go. I reread and proofread and do all that stuff. And I've been doing that with this as I get to the end of where I'm writing. And if I run out of like, oh crap, I don't know what to say next, I'll go back and start from the very beginning again. But the further I get into it, the longer that's going to take. So should I maybe just start at the beginning of the scene if I can
I would suggest, so I've got another episode that people should listen to, and maybe, you know, if you haven't already, take a look at it. It's called 7 C's of Story. So what I advise people do is they first figure out what are the big 7 C's of their story. So 4 of them are plot events that happen in the story, you know, the conflict, the catalyst, or there's the catalyst, the commitment moment, the crisis moment, and the climax moment. So there's actual major plot points in the story. And then there's 3, like, you know, meta level things. Who are the characters? What is the conflict? And what change takes place? Now, if you figure those 7 C words out, if you don't have that, you've got nothing.
Okay.
And everything is spinning your wheels. And that's fine to spin your wheels till you figure these things out. But it is more efficient to have them figured out, because then you can start pulling everything in line with it. So without running that down, you know, and it's taking a lot of time, I would say, like, people should check out that 7 C's of Story. Those are the big 7 blocks. 4 of those are scenes that you have to write into your script. And I would say, like, if you can get those scenes figured out first, like, what are those scenes going to be? Like, what's the big climax? What's the big, you know, commitment? In other words, why don't they leave the house?
Right. Why can't they leave the house? Right.
There's a scene where it's determined that they have to solve this problem, right, that they have. So one, you got to figure out what the conflict is. Like, what's the problem they're trying to solve? And you get into, like, weird abstract idea conversations. So, for example, Dan, why does it matter that the meat house is killing them? What's the problem that it creates for them? I know it sounds like a strange question. What is the problem that meat house killing them one by one has created for them?
That they're going to die?
But that's not a problem in horror. In horror, the best thing that can happen to you is that you die. Because what matters in horror is the fate worse than death that the monster represents. So now we're going to get far afield here, but the point I'm trying to make here is you need to figure out some big, big rocks before you start noodling around in the weeds. Unless noodling around in the weeds is helping you figure out those big, big rocks.
Okay.
And I would say once you have those big seven things, four of which are major plot moments, those are your big tentpole scenes in the script. Once you have those figured out, then you can start to get some structure figured out. Then you start to figure out where's the act breaks. You know, where's the big, again, what are the other big tentpole moments? Like, what's the fun of this movie for the audience? Where are the big payoffs for the audience? What are the things they want to see? And horror films is often the kills. Figure those kills out, you know?
Yeah.
Start figuring out, start like getting the big rocks in the jar before you start worrying about like the little things that are going to kind of connective tissue them.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise you're just going to be endlessly rewriting that stuff anyway. And you'll spend all your time and you'll use all your writing time, like writing lines of dialogue that you have to cut.
Okay. Okay. So what's the next step?
I would say I would suggest that one thing you do with Meat House is just get firm on what those seven like C's are. Maybe you've already got them figured out.
I have to actually
maybe you need to think
of it in those terms.
More about them, but really like figure the big sort of things out, you know, and then specifically get those four scenes figured out. Even if you get them not 100% figured out, but you kind of figure out, okay, here's the coordinates of like where I want them to be at this point. By the climax, I want this to happen. You know, this is the problem that they're committed to solving. Here's the thing they have to do at a certain point. How do I get them from A to Z? You kind of figure out like what's A and what's Z, you know, and then figuring out how to get them from A to Z is a smaller problem, although it's probably where you'll spend most of your time eventually.
Yeah.
But if you don't know what Z is and you haven't picked out A, it's hard to know where you are, and it feels overwhelming.
Okay. So give me a deadline. When do I have to have this done?
Well, are you going to be coming in Wednesdays like normally here? Let's say the next time you're coming into podcast with you and me.
So it'll be, I think, 2 weeks.
Sure. Let's say 2 weeks from now.
Okay.
I want to hear, you will have listened to the seven C's of story, and everyone listening can do the same. And you will have your seven C's, and we'll just kind of run down, do we think that works? And then, you know, start figuring out how to actually structure a script around some of this stuff, because you're going to get it. The sort of the meta level of it is you figure out the big tent poles of what this story is, and then you break it down into your acts. You break it down to sequences inside your acts. You break it down into scenes inside your sequences. You break it down into beats inside your scenes. And I recommend people do all that in an outline. Either they're writing a prose outline or they're putting it on cue cards. I like cue cards personally because you can move them around. Now, some people just write a script and that's how they do it, but it's not an efficient way to work.
Okay. Well, we'll see where I'm at in 2 weeks. Sounds good. This is what I need. I need someone to help me, motivate me, because otherwise I'm not doing it. I just kind of spinning my wheels, but just picking the time to write.
Well,
I'm not making that as much of a priority.
And the problem is it's hard to make it a priority because you don't know if you're making progress.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. And you need to tell me if I'm making progress. So,
well, but also the story can only tell you if you know, if you have your handle on certain things, then you get like more of a roadmap and you kind of check boxes. And yeah, maybe things will change, but you at least know like, okay, I've got 80 boxes to check and I've checked, you know, three of them. And last week I only had one. So like you can see the progress.
Right.
It's more motivating to know you're making progress than to just, I've got a bunch of pages. I don't know if any of them are going to get.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, thanks for opening yourself to the Meat House. Thanks for considering the rules. And to all you listening and to Dan Vadaponkur, keep writing the wrong way.